Welcome to a Troubadour podcast production of Benito Cereno by Herman Melville. Now, one of my purposes with this introduction and this entire series is to give you a real experience of this incredibly involved, intense, and complicated, and simple in some ways, text by Herman Melville. This is a text that I think is relevant and required reading for everybody in the West, and in particular, every American should know this tale. This is as important or more important than reading Herman Melville's Moby Dick and some of his other work, as well as other American writers of the 19th century. Now, to explain more about this premise that you should read certain classics, I think it's important to understand the context of where we are in America today. Why does there seem to be in 2020, on the eve of an election, when I'm recording this, on the eve of the 2020 election, there still seems to be such discontent among the quote-unquote races? Why does there seem to be such a concept as race relations? Why aren't we just one peoples like you find in other nations, like Chinese peoples or Japanese peoples? What is unique about America? More importantly, we want to think about what are the underlying ideas and characters in our culture. You're a character. I'm a character. The characters on screen, the characters we see in politics, the characters we see popping out of our culture on magazines, on music videos, and of course, television and movie. Where do these characters come from? What are their roles and how do we understand them? And when we see these characters, a lot of them political figures now, we see characters like Black Lives Matter leaders and rioters and protesters, the legitimate ones or illegitimate ones, and the things happening today. And we think about the opposite of that. And then we think, you know, we think about people with tiki torches running people over, and we see the vitriol on both sides and the hatred that tearing the country apart. But those, whether we understand it or not, those are small subsections of a 300 plus million population. So you have only a small set that really goes out and protests and riots. You know, an even smaller subset of that that goes out and riots. And the same thing with the people on the opposing end of that, where you have some people protesting today for Black Lives Matter, and then you have some white supremacists opposing them. Now that small subset does exist and it is relevant, and there's people that are sympathetic to either sphere. But what's more, I think, relevant for Americans is the man who's trying to understand what's happening between those two. What is going on? How do we know what kind of decision to make? How do we know who's in the right, who's in the wrong? Where's the hatred coming from, and how do we comprehend that? And this is one of my critical reasons for why we should particularly read this tale, Benito Cereno by Herman Melville. There's many aspects to it that are revealing for our current day, but that is one of the core, is this interesting intersection. And I call it interesting, but it's really a bizarre intersection between multiple facets of people who have enmity toward each other. And then you have somebody who has no enmity, which is the vast majority of Americans, the vast, vast, vast majority of Americans who just want to work, who just want to go out and, you know, be a baker, a plumber, a lawyer, a doctor. They want to be an actor, a director, a writer, a teacher, you know, a philosopher, whatever it is. They have, you know, an accountant, or they just want to have a family and they don't care what they do at home or for work as much, and they're just trying to raise their family. Those people, the vast, 95, 99%, 98% of Americans, they're the ones trying to figure out these extreme subsets that are, on the news, vitriol. We hear about them all the time, and they seem to be tearing everything apart. And you have this person, we can call them in the middle, this 98%, and I'm calling them the vast majority of us. We can call them, like I said, in the middle, and they're trying to understand, to comprehend the various sides in all of these issues. And especially if we take the 2020 election, if we think about something like race relations, which is going to be really relevant for the story Benito Cereno. So Benito Cereno, I'm going to tell you, is going to pose an epistemological quandary. And it is a very epistemological story, as we'll explore when you go through this. And the quandary is essentially a man who is incapable of comprehending the events around him is put in a situation where he must do exactly that, that's comprehending. So what is Benito Cereno? What am I talking about here? So Benito Cereno is a story written in 1855 and published in 1855 by Herman Melville. So note the time here, 5 years prior to the Civil War. And it has to do with in 1799, off the coast of Chile, a real captain. So this is a real historical event. And this is in 1799. Captain Amasa Delano of the American Sealer. That's a whaling ship, Sealer. So you're going to hear that. And I'm going to try to give you some terms to help you understand the text when I read it. Of the American Sealer and merchant ship Bachelor's Delight visits the San Dominique. That's a ship. A Spanish slave ship that looks like it's in distress. When Amasa Delano, the captain of Bachelor's Delight, arrives on the ship, he meets a captain, Benito Cereno, who tells him a tale of a storm that has destroyed many of the people on the ship and all of their provisions. Now, Delano offers to help, and as he and his men are bringing provisions, fish, water, other things that they may need, and even offers crew members to this ship, Amasa Delano, notices some bizarre events. And I don't want to give it away, but he starts to get a sinking feeling and then an eerie feeling. And then he's just confused. And then he doesn't know where he is, and he doesn't know what's going on, and things that are up seem down. And he's so lost all of a sudden. This is then what is going on in the thriller aspect of this story, is what is going on this ship. And that's what we're going to be exploring. And that's a big part of what we're going to be exploring. Now, I want to let you set up kind of how we're going to go about this. I'm going to actually read in segments this novella. So this is considered in 1855 a novella. It's over 100 pages. And I think in my reading, it's almost not quite a 4-hour read. So it's a significant novella. It's not a short story. It's, like a short story today is anything under 7,500 words, which is like, 12 pages double spaced or something. Back then, they had real writers. They didn't mess around. And it's worth reading and worth investigating. And in order to help you with understanding this text, I'm going to, like I said, read it to you. And after, I'm breaking it up into 4 parts. And after every part, I'll kind of sum up what you just listened to and give you some commentary. And then we'll go to the next part. And, the way that this, I hope, will help you is that, one, it'll break up this complex piece, because often, if you're doing this kind of passively listening to a podcast, you might miss some really critical things. And in fact, this is a story that, if I can encourage you to skip my reading of it and actually read the text yourself, it'll be very valuable. Or at least listen to my reading of it and then go back and read it for yourself. There is immense value in the writing. There is a special very unique way that he wrote this text that is actually kind of puts you in the mindset of what one of the deep themes epistemologically that he's trying to accomplish. And that is one of the themes that we're going to explore here, is the epistemological, you know, experience that I was telling you about, of having a man who's not quite sure what's going on. And really, he, as a man, he's from Duxbury, Massachusetts. He's just a normal whaling captain. It's a normal run of the mill, you know, guy next door. If you know the term Babbitt, that would come into play, Sinclair Lewis, a little bit later. He's that kind of guy. He's, you know, pretty optimistic, and he doesn't really know. He's very innocent, is another term that can be used for him. And we'll talk about the character as we go. And he is put in a place where he must, it's incumbent upon him to figure out what exactly is going on. Now, just to give you a kind of a sense of how difficult this text can be, I do want to read one sentence to give you a sense. And I don't want to scare you away, but I want to prepare you for what I think is a challenging text. "But as if not unwilling to let nature make known her own case among his suffering charge, or else in despair of restraining it for the time, the Spanish captain, a gentlemanly, reserved-looking and rather young man to a stranger's eye, dressed with singular richness but bearing plain traces of recent sleepless cares and disquietudes, stood passively by, leaning against the mainmast, at one moment casting a dreary, spiritless look upon his excited people, at the next an unhappy glance toward his visitor." Now, I looked at this sentence carefully, and the sentence is if you know basic grammar, the basic root of this sentence is, "the Spanish captain stood passively by, leaning against the mainmast." That's basically it. Everything else, and that was one sentence I just read to you, everything else is kind of the way that Delano, and this is a perspectival story, and we'll get into that as we go through too, but it's the way Captain Delano perceives this Spanish captain who's just kind of standing passively by, leaning against the mainmast. You know, if not unwilling to let nature make known her own case among his suffering charge, or else in despair of restraining it for the time, the Spanish captain, a gentlemanly, reserved-looking, and rather young man to a stranger's eye, he dressed with singular richness, but bearing plain traces of recent sleepless cares and disquietudes. Right, so what's that about? "And stood passively by, leaning against the mainmast, at one moment casting a dreary, spiritless look upon his excited people." Right, so just some context is, this is on the ship that Captain Delano is entering, to the distressed ship, to help them out. Right, and he's trying to figure out what's going on. "And all of his people are excited, but at the next, he gives an unhappy glance toward his visitor." Now, why would he give an unhappy glance toward his visitor? Like, what's happening? And is that just his perception? Is there something wrong with the way that Amaso Delano is looking at everything? And these are the kinds of, you know, mysterious things that happen. And that's just one minor mystery. There's a lot of mysteries that are going on. Now, before I close this introduction, I want to give you some other reasons why you should invest real time and effort into understanding Benito Cereno. I believe that texts, great classic texts, should be enjoyed as just great stories. So this is an interesting story in the sense of, a man is, you know, a ship captain in 1799, goes onto a distressed ship, and there is a weird mystery, and, you know, he has to figure it out in order to get off that ship. And that's an important thriller mystery. And so it's an exciting mystery and thriller to figure out that basic plot. But more, there's something deeper that is valuable in literature of this stature. And one of the things that I'm going to be arguing, not the only thing, one of the major ones that I want to show and talk about is the idea of what underlies nihilism. And I think this is particularly relevant to our day and age today, when we see nihilism all around us. what is it that leads people to be nihilistic? And we're going to talk a little bit about what nihilism is, but let's, and I'll actually, if you go to troubadourmag.com, I'm going to share a video by Professor Ankar Gatte, who did a short little interview where he talked about nihilism and how nihilism means, you know, comes from nigh, nothing. And it's basically the belief, you know, the essential meaning of the word is belief or valuing nothing, to believe in nothing and have no fundamental beliefs. And so there is a question of what kind of a person has that? Like, how can you survive if you don't believe in anything? And, you know, how can you get up in the morning? What is the point if you don't believe in family, or if you don't believe in living, if you don't believe in, you know, the importance of working hard to achieve something like a house, a family, a career that you enjoy, productive work that you're proud of? If none of that matters to you, if none of those values are real to you and they don't exist, or, you know, it's all for naught and there is no meaning in the world. Well, that's what nihilism basically is. We can have lots of examples today of nihilism. I think if you want to see a popular culture example, look no further than the Joker, particularly the Joker in the movie The Dark Knight. And just as an example, you know, like, it's the idea in that movie of he just wants to see the world burn. And he literally lights a whole stack of money on fire. So he's not a criminal in the sense that a criminal wants the money. All the other criminals in Gotham City want the money. So they just want to short circuit the process to get the money. But he doesn't. You know, he says, oh, it's not about that. It's about sending a message. But really, it's about destroying it. And the message, you know, you can watch that movie to see a little bit more, but that's a real visual example of an extreme example, I should say, of nihilism. And you see this with rioters and with people who say it's okay to riot and let's bring down the system and defund the police and all these things. Like, that's nihilism. It's not nihilism. Like, it would not be nihilism if they said these things: let's tear down capitalism, let's tear down American system, let's tear down defund the police, in order to put up this, right? In order to put up this utopia or this, you know, better society or something. If they had something better to offer, that would be something else. That's not what's happening. What happens is they're simply about tearing down. They don't say anything about what they're trying to build. And that is nihilism. And so in this story, which comes before Nietzsche, so this is a story that comes before Nietzsche. It's a story that, you know, maybe Nietzsche would have read. I mean, it's not the only story, but it's one of many in the mid-1850s that is kind of showing this, what leads to nihilism and what in a human, on an individual, in your soul, must take place for that to happen. And that's one of the things that we're going to be looking at and exploring. We're also going to be looking at the American system and the way that certain things have developed from this, you know, pre-Civil War. And there's something that exists in our natures as Americans that I think has manifested over the course of, really, it's, you know what, since 1855, I mean, it seems like forever ago, but it's not that long, really, in the scope of the humanities, right? If you look at thousands of years ago, ancient Greece, and, you know, 10,000 years ago, the beginning of civilization type, you know, modern civilization. And, you know, so we're talking like 1850, you know, 170 years, right? 165 years, something like that. It's a long time, but it's not as long as we might think. And my point is that it still has impacts today, and it's still very relevant to today. To quote Ayn Rand, it's sooner than you think. Okay, so here are some ideas that we're going to be exploring with this nihilism and the perspectival. So that's the other important element, is the how does a perspective play on us? How does a narrative, the narrative we believe, play on us individually? But I want to stick on this nihilism because I think I've read several of Melville's pieces, including Moby Dick, Bartleby, Billy Budd, Benito Cereno, and various other pieces. And I haven't read everything by him by any stretch. I've read a good amount. And I think one big question in much of Melville's work is what motivationally leads to nihilism? You know, and is there an answer to that question? to is there a respite or a salvation at the end of having your world turned upside down? Because I'm going to tell you that that's one critical aspect that leads to nihilism, is having your entire world and all the meaning that you got out of that world eviscerated or taken from you. So, for example, in Moby Dick, Moby Dick's Ahab, and if you haven't read it, that's fine. Most people have not read Moby Dick and probably never will. It's another dense, difficult read, but it's worth the study. But one of the big things happens, and you probably know this, is that Ahab goes from a hunter to hunted. And so this flipped worldview really destroys him. And in order for him to restore his worldview, he must kill the white whale. That's why the white whale, and he's obsessed with revenge, and he infuses the white whale with meaning and purpose. And he says, it's not just a whale. It's a devilfish. It's put here by Poseidon and God, you know, and it's part of the battle between God and the devil. And I'm in the middle and I have to, you know, be on the side of God and destroy this beast. And, you know, he meets another ship captain, for instance, who also lost a limb to Moby Dick, to the white whale. And when he talks about it, he just says, well, you know, it's unfortunate. I wish it didn't happen, but it happened, you know, and it's just part of the job. And that's how this captain looks at it. It's just a fish being a fish. But that's not how Ahab puts it. He puts it in this, to him, because part, you know, it's part of why you should read the book. It's part of what's in his soul of being this great souled man, that he has to put it into this epic, you know, view of values and meaning, because he has lost all meaning now and he has to find it. And there's a quote in the story toward the end where he says, is Ahab Ahab? Is it I, God? Or who is it? I, God, or who that lifts this arm? Is Ahab Ahab? That is something that leads to nihilism. Is Ahab Ahab? Am I Ahab, the one who raises this harpoon to destroy this beast? And is it I that's driving me? Is the I at the center of me? Do I really have the free will that I imagined? And, you know, philosophically, what we're getting in this era, and that we have dominant in our own era. So at this time in 1850s and the early 1800s, they're still questioning, they're still fighting for the idea of free will. Now, today, I think that fight's mostly dead. There are very few people in literature, in movies, in philosophy, in culture, like politics or anything else, that are fighting for free will. And so the question is Ahab, Ahab is no. You know, if you listen to a popular thinker like Sam Harris, it's determinism. You know, he was determined to lift his arm, just like, you know, based on a whole series of events that happened before him that led him to that moment. And so when he asked the question, is it I, God, or who that lifts the arm, this arm, it's something. It's more like the who in those segments of phrases, I, God, or who, or, you know, who is it that's doing this? It's a whole series of, you know, of effects and cause and effects that led to that moment. Well, this doubt about agency, of self-responsibility, if it goes unchecked, will lead to nihilism. And I think that's something that the focus of this story is not nihilism. I'm going to make that clear. The focus of the story is something I'm trying to get at, that, or one of the major focuses that leads to nihilism, that if you have that doubt and then you lose the idea that you do have agency, nihilism is an inevitable, or at least one critical, I think it's the inevitable result of that. It has to be in many ways. And we can talk about why that happens or has to happen in the work. Now, just so you know, I hope I'm not spoiling too much, but Ahab, in a sense, chooses hatred. And he chooses that hatred is real. That's meaning. And my hatred for the fish is why, that's my meaning. That's my solution to this problem of realizing that there is no meaning, or that there's possibly no meaning. And really, it was just an accident that this fish bit off my leg as I was hunting it. It was just a freak accident of nature. It had no motive, and his whole world is turned upside down. And this hunter who is a hunted, has to get that back. And what he holds on to in the end is hatred. I think that's a big part of Ahab's character. And then of course there's more complex than that, but that's a big part of it. And you see this kind of theme of free will and agency and, in many other works, including Bartleby, The Scrivener, which is a great one. And in that one, you might've heard the famous phrase, I would prefer not. And in that story, we have essentially a law office where they're scriveners and they're writing down, documents for lawyers. And one of the scriveners who is in this very orderly, everything operates based on a certain set of principles. It's all done verbally and through an ordered mechanism of language and written word. This one scrivener decides that he's going to simply decides, think about the word preference, my preference, my personal preference is that I'm not going to do this thing. And so whenever his boss tells him to write something up, he says, I would prefer not. When he says to leave the law offices, I would prefer not. So the action he decides to take is an inaction, but he decides it. And by having that agency, he throws the whole world into disarray. And since they can't use force because they're men of reason and, or at least men of the word in this law offices, they are unable to do much with him. And it's like a conundrum of what they could do. And you have to read the story to find out a little bit more about what they do. But this idea of agency, who has control, where's the control, where does that lie? Is there anything in you that has that? That is critical for understanding Melville's work. And especially this will be true in Benito Cereno. Okay. So the way that this is going to work is, on my podcast, it's Troubadour Podcast, and you can find it anywhere online and anywhere that they have podcasts, Apple, Spotify. Spotify is my preference. I'm going to break this down into various parts. So this introduction is part one. The reading, which will come next, and I'll upload it simultaneously, will be part two. After that, I'm going to have a summary of that part of part two, and then discussion. A part three will be the discussion of part two. And now the book, in this case, Benito Cereno, is actually, there are no chapters. It's 100 pages, and basically until the last, 15, 20 pages, it's all just one straight narrative of 80 pages with no stops. But I'm breaking it up in my own way just for your own sake. Now, if you want, you can just read it yourself and skip and, you can try to figure out where I stopped. But I basically stop every 20 odd pages or so. So that will be Benito Cereno. I hope I've given you some motivation to understand that critical character, especially in American society, the critical character who, for instance, right now is trying to make a decision about 2020, but on a even more specific, so that's a broad case of a decision they're trying to make, or we as Americans are trying to make. There's also just how do you feel about these fractured systems and these fractured events that are occurring that are seemingly, and I think realistically, tearing our country apart? And there is, I think, something incapable. There is something that is unable within the American spirit. If the person is a true American in spirit. And we'll talk about this is something actually Ayn Rand pointed out herself, not in this exact way, but she mentioned something about Americans. And I think it's relevant that we'll explore later. There's a characteristic in the culture, in the individual Americans, that is representative very well in Captain Amasa Delano, who is, by the way, the perspective we're seeing this whole event from. So the story is called Benito Cereno, who is the ship captain of the Spanish ship San Dominique, but we're actually seeing this event of what happens on that ship, and I don't want to reveal it, through Captain Amasa Delano's perspective. Although it's not first person, I'm going to say it's third person limited is the actual technical point of view. And it's, by the way, if you're a literary person, it's a very good example of what third person limited looks like. And I think Herman Melville does a beautiful job of it. So prepare yourself for some challenging syntax, but for a really interesting story, pay attention to the similes, the metaphors, the analogies, the imagery. Much of the juiciness of the story is not merely the plot. The plot is really critical, but it's the style and it's the way that this person is unfolding, or this event is unfolding in front of the eyes of Amasa Delano. And that is what's really critical, is it's what, how he perceives what's going on, or misperceives, or a mixture of perceives and misperceives, depending on what event's going on. And you know, I don't want to, like I said, give it all away, but you can kind of see as we go what's happening here. Okay, so tune in to part two, which will be a reading of the first segment of Benito Cereno by Herman Melville.